organizations were saying that we can't do a lockdown. Why? Not because of the virus, but because people were committing suicide.
Come on.
Wow.
This is the West,
yes.
right? It's different
yes.
in the West, right?
Yeah, I know.
They said, okay, either people will die from the virus, but that will be less.
Or to suicide.
But if we lock them in their houses, they're going to die from suicide, and that will be much, much more.
But we feel
because most of them,
too.
I guess, are living alone, that's why.
Living alone, I don't know, they just...
Not having the goal life. Yeah. You know, the fear of death. They have because they feel empty about afterlife.
So we can do nothing to these pandemics except to be prepared for the other ones to come.
But
this preparation is just to, you know, work on ourselves, have a good mental status in a way that we could cope with these calamities in a better way. And then I guess... The things that we learned from it is that totally, if I want to say just the gist of what we learned, is that today is very important and life is not eternal. We're not going to live here forever. If you have the gist of the lessons that you have learned, you can add it to me as well.
Don't trust people.
Don't trust people in every single thing they say.
Yeah, just I would say follow the leader. If the next pandemic hits, I know what I'm doing. I'm going inside my house. I'm waiting to see what the leader says, and I'm just listening to it. That's it.
Yeah.
I'm not opening my ears to all these random groups again.
Yeah, of course.
Listening to what all these different people. Everybody's an expert. No, no.
Yeah. So, sister, you in one sentence.
Yeah. Appreciate the beloved ones.
Yeah, that is very true. Yeah. That one is very important.
I do agree.
Yeah, we don't know how more days we're going to have together, so we have to just appreciate this moment and to share love with everyone that is close to you and to all the human beings around you.
Yeah.
So that's it. That's all the time that we have for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. Until another session, I bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
يا الله يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي لدي أمة رائزك يا الله يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي Let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime's new fascist government has intensified its attacks against Palestinians, which constitutes a war crime. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Truthout wrote in this regard, in a little over a month, the Zionist regime's prime minister has killed Palestinians, demolished their homes, mounted incursions into occupied Palestinian territory, and endeavored to change laws and policies to accelerate the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians from Palestine. This year marks the 75th anniversary of Nakba, the Arabic word for catastrophe. In 1948, the Zionist regime assumed control over more than three-quarters of Palestine. Upwards of 700,000 Palestinians were driven from their homes or forced to flee, and the Zionist regime confiscated much of the land. Now, the Zionist regime's new extremist government, the most anti-Palestinian in the Zionist regime's history, aims to finish the job by incorporating all of the occupied Palestinian territories. Bezalel Smotrich, head of the Zionism Party, is the new Minister of Finance. In 2021, he told Arab members of the Israeli regime Knesset that they were here By mistake, because Ben-Gurion didn't finish the job and throw you out in 1948. In his effort to Judaize the occupied West Bank and East al-Quds, the Zionist regime may be trying to cleanse the Palestinians from them. Richard Falk, former UN Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territories occupied since 1967, wrote an email to Truth Out, "The new Israeli government is the culmination of decades of apartheid subjugation of the Palestinian people in their homeland." In 1967, the Zionist regime attacked Egypt, Jordan, and Syria and seized the Palestinian territories of the West Bank, Gaza, and Al-Quds, as well as the Golan Heights and the Sinai Peninsula. Palestinians call this the Nakba. It ushered in the Zionist regime's prolonged occupation of Palestinian territory, but UN Security Council Resolution 242 passed in 1967 and reaffirmed in 2016, stipulates the inadmissibility of the acquisition of territory by war. The Palestinian Center for Human Rights, PCHR, has documented killings, house demolitions, and incursions by the Zionist regime's occupying forces, IOF, against Palestinians since the beginning of 2023. 43 Palestinians, including 19 civilians, 7 of whom were children, were killed by the IOF. 3 Palestinians were killed by settlers, allegedly in retaliation for shooting and stabbing attacks, and dozens were injured in the occupied West Bank, including East al-Quds. The 4th Geneva Convention forbids the punishment of people in an occupied territory for offenses they didn't personally commit. The Zionist regime's reprisals against families and the community for actions they did not take constitutes collective punishment, which is considered a war crime. In addition, the IOF rendered 33 families homeless, a total of 229 individuals, including 43 women and 108 children. This was the result of IOF demolitions of 34 houses. 6 were forced to demolish their own homes, and 3 were demolished in an exercise of collective punishment. The IOF also demolished 39 other civilian objects, razed other property, and delivered dozens of notices of demolition, cease construction, and evacuation in the West Bank, including East al-Quds, PCHR reported. IOF conducted 1,449 incursions into the West Bank, including occupied East al-Quds, since the beginning of 2023. During these incursions, 638 Palestinians were arrested, including 11 women and 61 children. Moreover, 2022 was the deadliest year for Palestinians in the occupied West Bank in 18 years. The IOF killed at least 146 Palestinians, including 34 children. The new Zionist coalition government has begun the process to prevent the Israeli regime's Supreme Court from overruling legislation passed by the Knesset. There are proposals for the coalition to select judges and replace professional legal advisors with political appointees. The new regime has also withheld nearly $40 million in Palestinian tax revenues and plans to divert that money to victims of Palestinian attacks. Meanwhile, guidelines published by the government call for more construction of Jewish settlements in the occupied West Bank, legalization of illegal outposts, and eventual full annexation of the West Bank. The Fourth Geneva Convention prohibits an occupying power from transferring parts of its own civilian population to the territories it occupies. It is illegal for the Zionist regime to directly or tacitly support the building of Jewish settlements on Palestinian land. In 2016, the UN Security Council adopted Resolution 2334, which condemned the fabricated regime of Israel for the establishment of settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories, including East al-Quds. It says that the building of settlements has no legal validity and constitutes a flagrant violation under international law. Approximately 650,000 Jewish settlers live in 164 settlements and 116 outposts in the occupied West Bank. Settlers who illegally build settlements on Palestinian territory have been emboldened by the new regime, which includes leaders for the settler movement among its key ministers. Also, the website of Middle East Eye noted Netanyahu's strategy was exposed last week when the Zionist regime's army raided the Palestinian town of Jenin, killing 10 Palestinians, including an elderly woman. That raid, as well as the provocative visit to Al-Aqsa Mosque by the Zionist regime's far-right security minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, triggered the beginning of the collapse of Netanyahu doctrine. In April 2002, the Zionist regime forces stormed the camp, killing more than 50 Palestinians. Around 24 Israeli regime troops were also killed in the operation. Many of Jenin's youth who are fighting the war today were babies or were not yet born during the Second Intifada. But the city's history of resistance is engraved into their identity, serving as motivation for their revolutionary actions against the Zionist regime occupation. Located on the periphery of the occupied West Bank, Jenin is geographically very close to Israel, which has facilitated Palestinian operations inside the country. And as the Zionist settlements continue to grow across the West Bank, separating the two regions is proving to be impossible.
Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us the sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah.
Almighty Allah, you are a true God.
To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome. You're listening to The Last Savior. This is your host, Zainab. I am with Dr. Karimi. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Welcome, sir. It's very important to know about the Imam of Time. We have time to time told you through narrations and through Quran how important it is to know about the Imam of Time. So we had been talking about the signs of reappearance. Talking about Sufyani, what is the time of the advent of Sufyani?
As you rightly mentioned, we are talking about the signs of the reappearance of Imam Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance, and of course the definite ones. And maybe one of the most important ones in terms of the signs is that of the uprising of Sufyani, because of the fact that, because of the number of the narrations that are quoted from the mouth of the Ahlul Bayt about this person himself, about all the details of his uprising, and also about the number of the countries which will be involved after his uprising. And of course, the other issue that I think we talked about is the fact that, his main goal is just to kill the Shia.
All right.
So that is why, as Shia, it is very important for us to know about different details of the uprising of Sufyani and himself. We talked about some of the details about him. And first of all, we would like to talk about the time of his uprising. Of course, we know that the time of his uprising is very close to the time of the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam.
All right.
And since we do not know any idea about the time of the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, we have no idea about the time of the uprising
his
of
uprising
Sufyani as well.
As well.
But the point is that there are a couple of points mentioned in the narrations that we may give us some explanations about the time of his uprising. The first point is that there are several narrations, and some of them are authentic, according to which the uprising of Sufyani will occur in the month of Rajab.
Okay.
So this is mentioned in several narrations, and as I mentioned, some of them are at least sahih and authentic, and we do not find any other narration saying otherwise. I mean, referring to the other month in the lunar calendar. In one narration, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says, "The uprising of Sufyani, the issue of Sufyani, is one of the definite signs. It will happen for sure. There is no bada occurring regarding this issue. He will begin his uprising in the month of Rajab." This is in Kamaluddin, chapter 57, page 650, hadith number 5.
Yes, we'll know more about it after a short break. Sure. Dear listeners, stay tuned with us.
I can feel your eyes like the sun shining behind the clouds. I need a morning to shatter this long night forever. This thousand-year-old
Welcome back, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. We're talking about the signs of reappearance. One of them is Sufyani, a person who is going to rise before the reappearance of Imam Zama.
Let me share another narration from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam again, according to which he is quoted as saying, "As Sufyani la budda min." Another phrase from the Imam to show us that there is no doubt about this sign. This is, for sure, one of the definite signs for the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. وَلَا يَخْرُجُ إِلَّا فِي رَجَبٍ. He will not begin his uprising except in the month of Rajab.
All right.
This is in Al-Ghiba by Nu'mani, page 313, hadith number 7. So this is one point about his uprising. At least it can guide us that if any person claims to be Sufyani but his uprising is not in the month of Rajab, we can make sure that he is not the Sufyani that the narrations are talking about.
All right.
The next point about the time of his uprising is that he is somehow, as we said before, is contemporary to the another important person before the reappearance of Imam Mahdi, and that is Yamani, that we talked about him in detail.
Yeah.
Yamani, of course, is a righteous person looking for righteousness and justice. And opposite to him, you have Sufyani, an oppressive person trying to kill
A character completely opposite
exactly
to that of Yamani.
And according to some narrations, as we said before, they will fight each other as well. So the other point regarding the time of Sufyani is that he is somehow simultaneous to Yamani. They will come together. And we refer to some narrations in this regard when we talked about the uprising of Yamani. For example, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam has been quoted as saying, Al-Khurasani wa Sufyani wal Yamani fi sanatin wahida wa shahrin wahid wa yawmin wahid. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, in this narration, which is an authentic narration quoted by Sheikh Tusi in his Al-Ghiba, page 446, talks about three people: Khorasani, who is another righteous man, Sufyani, and Yamani, and the fact that these three people will come in the same year, in the same month, and in the same day.
All right, so of even course, the day is same.
Yeah, we analyzed this narration before. Maybe this narration is referring to the fact that they are very close to each other. So they may not come exactly at the same day, but at least the narration is repeating, is referring to the same fact that we cannot have a Sufyani without Yamani, or Yamani without Sufyani. So if in our day a person comes and claims that I'm Yamani, but there is no Sufyani, it means that he's just a false
claimant.
Lying
is a false claimant. Yeah.
And in another narration, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says, Al-Yamani wa Sufyani kafarasai rehan. In a kind of metaphor, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says that Yamani and Sufyani are like two racing horses, meaning that they come together and they will fight each other. This is in Al-Ghiba by Nu'mani, chapter 18, page 316, hadith number 15.
Yeah.
And yet in another narration, Imam alayhi salam says that the uprising of Sufyani will be after the uprising of a man from Sana'a, which is the capital of Yemen. And this apparently is referring to the uprising of Yamani as well. Al-Ghiba by Nu'mani, page 285, hadith 60. So all these narrations, and among them we have some authentic ones, refer to the fact that, first of all, Sufyani will come in the month of Rajab, and second of all, he will come.
Will be contemporary to that of Yamani and Khorasani. Well, we'll talk more on the fact after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned with us. Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is The Last Savior. We are talking about a man whose name is Sufyani, and he is one of the definite signs of reappearance of Imam. And we as Muslims believe that he is the one who is going to be appearing before the advent of Imam Ajallah Ta'ala Faraja. And Dr. Karimi is helping us to know about the time of his reappearance, because there are many false claimants who say that I am Sufyani. So how we can actually recognize, is it the real certain sign of reappearance? Is it the real Sufyani who has been talked about a lot in the narrations? Yes, Dr. Karimi.
Yeah, following that, as I mentioned, we have another personality mentioned in some of the narrations, and that is a person coming from Khorasan, which may refer to the country of Iran, of course. And he is also a righteous man looking for justice, but he is not considered as one of the definite signs for the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. So, as I mentioned in that narration from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, also another narration from Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, he says, the uprising of Sufyani, Yamani, and Khorasani, all these three people are in the same year, and the same month, and on the same day. Al-Ghiba by Nu'mani, page 262, hadith number 13.
All right, so we have one thing very clear over here, that is Sufyani, Yamani, and Khorasani are going to appear in the same time. However, we have in narrations that Yamani and Sufyani are the very certain signs of reappearance. However, Khorasani has not been referred to as certain signs.
Exactly. This is the only difference between the two, that Bada may happen regarding the coming of Khorasani. Now, the point is that in some other narrations, the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt talk about some flags coming from Khorasan, or Khorasani flags, which apparently they are referring to this uprising of Khorasani. For example, in one narration, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam is quoted as saying, وَيَبْعَثُ السُّفْيَانِ جَيْشًا إِلَى الْكُوفَةِ وَعِدَّتُهُمْ 70,000 أَلْفًا. Sufyani will send an army of 70,000 people toward Kufa, which means toward the country of Iraq. And at the same time that Sufyani is killing the people of Kufa, meaning the people of Iraq, some flags come and proceed from Khorasan. Among them are some of the companions of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, and may Allah hasten his reappearance. This is Al-Ghibah by Nu'mani, page 288, hadith number 67. Another narration which tells us that it seems from the narrations that Khorasani also will be at the same time as Sufyani and, of course, Yamani. So we'll have these three personalities at the same time.
Having talked about the time of the uprising of Sufyani, what about the place of his uprising?
Yeah, when it comes to the place from which Sufyani will begin his uprising, because we will talk about the fact that he will conquer many cities, many countries, he will attack many countries. But what about the place that he will begin his uprising from? Because this is the most important part for us to know who Sufyani is.
Okay.
Because many people may begin their uprising from different places. But what about Sufyani? There are three groups of narrations in this regard. Let me just refer to the titles, and then we may refer to the narrations in the following sessions.
Yes.
According to the first group of the narrations, his uprising will begin from Sham or Syria, or rather Levant. I will talk about this word because it's not referring to today's place that is known as Sham or Syria.
Okay.
According to the second group of the narrations, he will come from a place called Wadi Yabes, which means a dry land.
Okay.
And according to the third group of the narrations, his uprising will begin from a region in the west.
Okay.
And of course, I will share some narrations for each group in the following session, and we will come to this conclusion that these narrations are not contradicting each other, and there is a way to reconcile between all these three narrations and to come to a clear conclusion regarding the place of the uprising of Sufyani.
All right, so we have something that would lead us to one conclusion through different narrations.
Exactly.
All right. We have known about the time of his uprising, and we have also, the one thing in the time is clear that it would be contemporary with Yamani and Khorasani's uprising. And in terms of place as well, there have been different narrations, which Dr. Karimi is saying that they will be leading to same conclusion. And what would be the conclusion? We will, inshallah, discuss that in the upcoming session. Thank you so much, Dr. Karimi, for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
The killing of black Americans or African Americans by U.S. police has been highlighted by U.S. media in recent years. These killings have become so normal that it seems Americans have accepted it because there is no police accountability in the United States. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered the story and tells us more. A new data analysis reveals US law enforcement killed at least 1,176 people in 2022, making it the deadliest year on record for police violence in the United States since experts first started tracking the killings. According to Mapping Police Violence, police across the country killed an average of more than 3 people a day, or nearly 100 people every month last year. The non-profit research group maintains a database of reported deaths at the hands of law enforcement, including people fatally shot by police, beaten or restrained or tasered. In 2021, police officers killed 1,145 people. 1,152 were killed in 2020. 1,097 individuals were killed by U.S. law enforcement in 2019. 1,140 were killed in 2018. And 1,089 were killed in 2017. The earliest data goes back to 2013, when advocates began counting these fatal incidents. A database run by the Washington Post, which tracks fatal shootings by police officers, also shows 2022 as a year with record killings. The data release comes 2 years after the murder of George Floyd, sparked national uprising calling for racial justice, police accountability, and reductions in funding and size of police forces throughout the United States. Despite the international attention and some local efforts to curb police brutality, there has been an intensifying backlash to criminal justice reform, and the overall number of killings has remained alarmingly high. Bianca Austin, the aunt of Breonna Taylor, whose March 2020 killing in Kentucky sparked mass protests throughout the United States, said, "It just never stops. There was a movement and uproar across the globe, and we're still having more killings. What are we doing wrong? It's so disheartening." While the numbers have crept up, the circumstances that precede the killings have remained consistent. In 2022, 132 killings, or 11% of the total, were cases in which no offence was alleged. 104 cases, or 9% of the total, were mental health or welfare checks. 98 cases, or 8% of the total, involved traffic violations. 207 cases, or 18% of the total, involved other allegations of non-violent offences. There were also 93 cases, or 8% of the total, involving claims of a domestic disturbance. And 128 cases, or 11% of the total, where the person was allegedly seen with a weapon. Only 370 cases, or 31% of the total, involved a potentially more serious situation, with an alleged violent crime. Samuel Sinyangwe, a data scientist and policy analyst who founded Mapping Police Violence and provided 2022 data to The Guardian, said, "These are routine police encounters that escalate to a killing. The reduction in the conversation around police violence does not mean that this issue is going away. What's clear is that it's continuing to get worse and that it is deeply systemic." The Bloomberg news agency has also covered the same story and tells us more. At least 1,176 people were killed by law enforcement officers in the United States last year, the most of any year since at least 2013. According to the non-profit organization Mapping Police Violence, which last updated its database on 31st of December 2022, that's 36 more people than in 2021. It may be an undercount as the organization continues to compile data, which it does regularly for all of the years it tracks. Of people killed by law enforcement last year, 287 were African Americans. The group found that 24% of the total number of police killings. U.S. Census data shows 13.6% of the population of the United States is black. Police shooting incidents accounted for 96% of the killings. The database also tracks killings by taser, vehicles, or other use of force. Native American and Pacific Islander populations were almost disproportionately affected by police violence. Calls to reform or defund police departments have grown from activists and protesters in past years, particularly in the wake of the May 2020 murder of George Floyd, an African-American man, by a white police officer. That year's Black Lives Matter protests are believed to be the largest movement in U.S. history, and international protests also decried anti-black police brutality. The 50 largest cities in the United States reduced their fiscal 2021 police budgets by 5.2% from the year prior in aggregate. But police funding also comprised a slightly higher percentage of the overall budgets. A Bloomberg analysis showed cities including Tampa, Florida, Phoenix, Arizona, increased their police funding in fiscal year 2021. New York and Minneapolis were among those cities that decreased their budgets that year. New York allocated $5.53 billion towards police spending in fiscal year 2023. In May of 2022, on the second anniversary of George Floyd's murder by a white police officer, President Joe Biden signed an executive order addressing police accountability. It included new policies on chokeholds and anti-bias training to fight racism within law enforcement. Mapping Police Violence found that 98.1% of police killings since 2013 have resulted in no police accountability. The database also examined the situation surrounding each killing, with at least a third occurring when the person did not present a threat to police officers. It stated, one in every three people killed by police officers was running away, driving away, or otherwise trying to flee the scene. Black and brown people were more likely to be killed whilst fleeing. The Washington Post has also covered the same story. In 32% of cases of police killings last year, the person was fleeing before they were killed, generally running away or driving off, cases in which experts say lethal force is unwarranted and also endangers the public. In June, Ohio police officers fired dozens of rounds at Jaylen Walker, who was unarmed and fleeing. Just a month later, a police officer in California exited an unmarked car and immediately fired at Robert Adams as he ran in the opposite direction. The racial disparities have also persisted. Black people were 24% of those killed last year, while making up only 13% of the U.S. population. From 2013 to 2022, black residents were three times more likely to be killed by a police officer than white residents. The inequality is particularly severe in some cities, including Minneapolis, where police officers have killed black residents at a rate of 28 times higher than those of white residents, and Chicago, Illinois, where the rate was 25 times higher for blacks compared to whites. Jacob Blake Sr., whose son was shot by Kenosha police and left paralyzed in 2020, said, "Police's ability to be judge, jury and executioner has been taken to another level. No matter how much we insist that it's wrong, society allows it to take place." Jacob Blake Sr. and Bianca Austin, aunt of Breonna Taylor, whose March 2020 killing in Kentucky sparked mass protests throughout the United States, run a group called Families United that assists people whose loved ones have been killed by police officers. Samuel Sinyangwe, the founder of Mapping Police Violence, also found that there had been a notable uptick in killings by sheriff's departments, which are generally county agencies run by their elected leader. In 2022, sheriffs were involved in 416 killings in the United States, higher than the share in 2013, which was 277 cases. It's unclear what's driving that increase, though Samuel Sinyangwe said there had been growing partnerships between sheriffs and other agencies, with sheriff deputies executing search warrants or doing chases that can result in death. He said sheriff's officers are also particularly politicized during elections, which could contribute to the problem. Samuel Sinyangwe added, "There are campaigns in which there's a race to the bottom to compete to be more tough on crime, and the result is more violent sheriff's departments."
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, ways of strengthening taqwa through abandoning the material things. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of strengthening the taqwa through abandoning the material things. We know that we are living in the material world, and in this material world, we have some material needs. But the problem occurs where we excessively go towards this material world, or when we consider that everything is this material world. Therefore, it is necessary to do not exceed the limits that are set by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala or the Islamic teachings. Therefore, the moderate way is the best way to be and to have the right way. The moderate way is the best way to follow the Islamic teachings. The moderate way is the best way to have the Islamic life. Therefore, it is necessary to follow the moderate way and do not to exceed the limits in this material world. The problem is we do not believe in Allah the way we should. When we do not believe, when we are under the propaganda of the material world, then our beliefs are not strong enough and they are affected by this material world or the concepts or the things that are being said through this in this material world. The way we study, the educational system that we have, this is all based on this, on the materialism. Therefore, we being a Muslim who believe in God, who believe in soul, who believe in hereafter, who believe that this world is something to work for the hereafter, and the mata of this world, the sustenance of this world is the passing enjoyments, we do not have the firm belief in the context the way we should have.
Thank you.
Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of strengthening the ways of taqwa through abandoning the material things. We said that it is necessary to follow the way in which we can worship Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Obviously, when we are abandoning the material things, it means that we are not going towards the material things only in order to gain the material, we can say, like enjoyments. Why? Because this world is a passing enjoyment, and the things that are provided in this world is for our help, so that we use them as a tool in order to have the best sustenance in hereafter, in order to have the best results in hereafter. Therefore, it is necessary to look at this world as a tool and to use whatever it is provided as the material source in this world as a tool for hereafter. On the other hand, we have the ahadith or the narrations in which it is said, for example, Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib has said that haramun ala kulli qalbin mutawallitin bid-dunya. It is haram, forbidden on every single heart to have the love of this dunya, and yaskanahu taqwa. It is haram on the heart in which there is the love of this dunya, the love of this world, that the taqwa should go and reside there. Which means that the taqwa, if we want to gain taqwa, if we want to strengthen the taqwa, we should not have the hubb of dunya, we should not have the love of dunya. Why? Because taqwa does not reside at a place where there is a love for this dunya, where there is a love for this material world, where a person can think that he can just live in this world and this world is the final destination. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
With you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The second phase of the revolution statement addressed to the Iranian nation on the occasion of the anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution of Iran by Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. It is possible to assume an expiry date for anything, yet the global mottos of this religious revolution are exceptional. They will never expire, because they match human nature in all eras. Freedom ethics, spirituality, justice, independence, dignity, rationality, brotherhood are not limited to a single generation or a society, so that they would rise in a period and decline in the next. The revolution distributed the country's public facilities in a manner closer to justice. If I, this very humble person, am not satisfied with the functioning of justice in the country, it is due to the fact that this lofty value should shine like a unique gem on the Islamic Republic. But it has not yet. However, my dissatisfaction should not be taken to mean that no work has been done for the establishment of justice. The reality is that the achievements made in combating injustice over the past four decades are not comparable to any other era in the past. During the regime of Taghut, tyrannical dynasties, most of the services and revenues of the countries were available only to a small group of the residents of the capital city or their counterparts in other parts of the country. The people in most cities, especially in remote areas and villages, were at the end of the list and often deprived of basic infrastructure and services.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The Islamic Republic has been one of the world's most successful governments in relocating its services and wealth from the center to all parts of the country and from affluent areas of the cities to the poor neighborhoods. The greatest statistics on building roads and housing construction, the establishment of industrial centers, the reformation of agricultural matters, distribution of electricity, water, as well as building medical centers, universities, dams and power plants, and the like, even to the most remote areas of the country, truly makes us proud. Certainly, all these efforts were neither reflected in an efficient propagation of the officials of the Islamic Republic, nor did the foreign and domestic malevolent enemies confess to it. Yet, it is there and remains as good deeds of jihadi, sincere managers before God and for the sake of people. Nevertheless, the notion of justice, as expected by the Islamic Republic, that seeks to follow the role model of a government founded by Imam Ali alayhi salam, is far superior to that, and I look forward to seeing you, the young people, realizing it.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. Guiding me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Lives have been saved in Turkey following recent earthquakes because the country had access to heavy lifting machinery. Experts say many lives were lost in Syria because sanctions prevented the country from having similar equipment. The catastrophe has just been debated in the European Parliament.
Following the disaster, I contacted one of the largest aid agencies in Syria. I've spoken to Italian agencies and other NGOs. They all told me that the EU sanctions present an obstacle to humanitarian work.
European Commission officials told legislators that just 9 of the EU's 27 member states have supplied Syria with support. 21 have scrambled to help Turkey.
The Commission also allocated an additional 3.5 million euros in emergency humanitarian funding to help our partners address urgent needs in Syria.
This 3.5 million euro for Syrians pales into insignificance when compared to the 67 billion euro spent by the EU on Ukraine during the past 11 months. Experts have been saying for years that the bloc lacks unity when it comes to Syria.
Countries are acting in their own way. There is no coordinated action. And this is one of the reasons that we're faced with this very big crisis, this mega crisis.
Efforts by Western nations to overthrow President Bashar al-Assad have failed. Critics say interventionism has brought misery to millions of innocent people in the country. Some lawmakers want the pressure to be paused.
In Syria, there are sanctions. We don't want to see more people die in the cold. They don't have medicines. We must put politics aside and human life first.
It's been announced the EU will host a donors summit next month to gather money for the earthquake-hit regions. Political commentators are claiming it's already obvious that the vast majority of the money raised will go to Turkey, not Syria. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
I am visiting a children's hospital in Kabul, which is said to be overwhelmed with malnourished kids. Every few hours, a sick child is brought into the malnourishment ward, while doctors and nurses are racing against time to save the youngest victims of Afghanistan's crisis.
Unfortunately, this year, undernourished cases, especially severe acute malnutrition, have significantly surged compared to last year. Constant hunger and poverty and differing diseases are to blame for this, which puts us in dire need of more supplies and medical aid.
As you know, Afghans are gripped with poverty and economic problems. As a result, we are overwhelmed with a huge number of malnutrition. We are running out of bed and sometimes we are forced to reject new entries. Besides, childhood wasting as well as child mortality have also soared.
The World Health Organization says in 2023, around 17,000 Afghan babies and mothers are expected to suffer from severe acute malnutrition, while over 2.3 million children may suffer from moderate acute malnutrition. The UN body adds that an estimated 28.3 million people, which comprises two-thirds of Afghanistan's population, need urgent relief assistance.
We are a family of 10. My husband is a shoemaker. This malnourished child of mine is 3 months old. Two of my children died as a result of wasting and stunting.
Afghan people's miseries are growing day by day. Unemployment, poverty, and famine have gripped the society, with poor and middle-class households being hit hard. Many have brought their malnourished kids here, and I think it is because they have no food in their houses. We are calling on the global community not to ignore Afghans amid political and economic crises.
Concerns are on the rise among Afghans over their isolation from the international community and major cuts in global aid following the Taliban's takeover and U.S. withdrawal from their country. Afghanistan has one of the highest rates of malnutrition in the world. Afghans are calling on the global community not to leave them alone amid poverty and hunger. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Hundreds of people attended a national conference in Gaza, which was organized by Palestinian resistance factions. The event aims to bolster the resistance in Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank. In recent weeks, extremist Israeli settlers and political figures, backed by regime forces, have been violating the sanctity of the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Al-Quds. Israeli forces have also killed and injured dozens of Palestinians in the occupied West Bank since the beginning of 2023. Speaking to Press TV, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas said the resistance in Gaza is ready to support the resistance in Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank.
We will not leave the resistance in Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank alone, and we will back them with all the necessary means. The occupying regime will not be able to divide the Palestinian resistance arenas. Last night, we witnessed unity in Gaza, Nablus, and Al-Quds.
Occupied by Israeli regime forces more than 55 years ago, Al-Quds has been at the